All right, so we're at that point in the season where I think it's a good opportunity for us to take stock of how Star Trek Voyager is using its main cast. And B'Elanna Torres gets another episode this week in Dreadnought. It's pretty good. I think Tom Paris has had one episode. Harry Kim has had one episode. And the Doctor has had, what, like 17?
Yeah, so, the Doctor is, I mean, the Doctor is my favorite character, and he's clearly the show's favorite character. Kes has had an episode. Tuvok had an episode or two, even.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the show is doing a pretty good job at parceling them out. And the only thing that I'm sort of wondering at this point is how you feel about how the show is using the main characters when they're not in an episode. Because I don't know that they're using them as well as they could be. Certainly characters like Harry Kim. And I think the show is using Neelix fairly well. I think the show is using using B'Elanna fairly well, but some characters like Harry Kim and Chakotay.
Yeah, no. A lot of the characters go in, they have their one line, and it's usually a nothing line like, "Captain, the deflector shield has a Tetrion aura about it." And that's Harry Kim. You know, he showed up, he got his paycheck, and he went home. You know, that was what he did that week.
Which I guess, I mean, is that a problem?
Well,
I'm not sure.
You know, again, I could, so this is a 9-member main cast. Firefly was a 9-member main cast, and maybe in some ways it's unfair to compare the two shows. But one of the things we always said in our podcasts about Firefly was that we did kind of know,
which you can find at tuninginshow.com.
Even in episodes that would focus mainly on one character's story, they did a lot more with the ensemble. Now, that's a particular feature of Whedon's shows. He is very good at getting the ensemble together and getting all of that, but it's not. I'm not feeling that here. You don't really know or care what Harry Kim is doing during the events of Dreadnought. And it's not a problem that that's not the case. It's fine if a character has just had a really boring week this week and did nothing, didn't really serve in the events of the plot, didn't even really have anything to do with the B plot. It's just, it's another sign of, we talked a lot about DS9 as a transitional series in between episodic television and, then the more serialized storytelling that began in earnest in the 2000s. We are also on tuninginshow.com talking about X-Files, which is even more influential of a transitional series into how it brought us into more serialized storytelling. And Voyager is not that show. Voyager is still episodic television. If the plot is vaguely progressing, or if events do build on other plots, and again, we are seeing with this one person who is chatting with the Kazon, or this pregnant woman who is appearing from episode to episode. Yes, these little plots are progressing from episode to episode, but it is fairly self-contained, and so that does lead for nothing interesting happening to somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple thoughts about that. I think that my first thought is, I find it interesting how Voyager is using its ensemble cast, because TNG had a very family feel. And yes, Picard was kind of a man alone, and he did not get involved in a lot of the shenanigans, poker games, you know, Parisi Square tournaments and things of that nature that they were doing. But for the most part, you really did get a sense that everyone in the main cast liked each other and hung out with each other in a large group. You didn't really get that sense so much on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine was very much more a show about pairings. And Voyager, I'm not sure yet what show it is. It doesn't really seem to be a show about an ensemble family feel. It also doesn't really seem to be a show about relationships. So, I mean, aside from little things like Harry Kim and Tom Paris' friendship, for instance, or Kes and the Doctor, or Kes and Neelix, I think aside from that, you don't get a good sense of any of these people hanging out outside of their duty shifts.
Yeah, it's even more of a workplace show, in a way. It's an unusual workplace, but this is their office life.
And I think in a way that makes sense, because if you think about the situation that they're in, they are essentially, this is everyone that they're going to see. They day in, day out, they're spending their time with all of these people, and there's no escape from it. That's even different from something like the USS Enterprise, where crew members would swap in and swap out. Yeah. You could get transferred to another posting. This
you
is
could take
for
shore leave for a week.
Right. And so this is it for them. I think if Harry Kim wants to go off in his quarters every night and play with his clarinet instead of hanging out in the mess hall, and I, you know, you could take that either way. I think that makes sense to me, because I think these people would probably want some separation from each other because they would get sick of each other. And the other thing I want to say, you know, kind of before we transition more into talking about Dreadnought, is that I kind of disagree with you that Voyager is certainly it's an episodic show, but I think especially I think the Kazon plot is a very interesting example of Voyager doing the kind of serialized storytelling that it's not really known for. And I say that because these are scenes that would not be out of place in a more serialized television show like Game of Thrones, where storylines go over from episode to episode. It may only be advanced by a scene here or there in any one number of episodes. And that's happening on Star Trek Voyager. And that's not something that TNG or even DS9 did, really.
No, it's true. While their TNG, for example, had this very long arc about the Klingon political upheavals and Gowron becoming chancellor and all of that, and Worf's family, that was all just, we wrote an episode, and then at some point later, we looked at that and said, all right, they were more sequels to each other, sequel episodes. This entire, as I said, there is going to be some point to this guy contacting the Kazon, and you get the sense that several episodes ago, they figured out the whole where this is going to go, and they're threading this through as it's going on. So they kind of have an endpoint in mind, or at least a general direction of it.
Yeah, I think that's really right. And I think a perfect example of that kind of storytelling in Dreadnought, aside from the Kazon and the Maquis having another conversation, is what's going on with Tom Paris. Because I remember I mentioned to you last week that his gambling ring was going to kind of come back. And it's somewhat related to his adventures in being late with Messy Hair this week and getting into fights. Something's going on with Tom Paris that seems to be something that the show is trying to thread throughout this season.
Well, Tom Paris has gone through. Yeah, I mean, it seems almost like in as part of the continuity with the whole Kessa Neelix bit. I mean, dealing from what? Yes, he was certainly flirting with Kes, but he probably, you know, he didn't really seem to intend or expect anything more, and that just blew up into this big thing. That's a big blow to him. Dealing with what he did last week, where he finally accomplished something meaningful with his life and he turned into a lizard and had egg babies with the captain. I mean, he has gone through a lot of shit, and I guess they are showing that taking its toll on him. It's true.
Yeah, and I like it. I mean, I think it makes sense. It doesn't really call attention to itself. And it's just another way to sort of indicate that, you know, if a crew member on Voyager is having problems, they can't really do the kind of standard things that they would do. I mean, you know, in the gambling episode, for example, Chakotay says he's putting him on report, right? Or is that this episode? I forget. But at some point, Chakotay says that he's putting Tom Paris on report, and Paris just sort of scoffs at him. You know, I mean,
certainly when he's addressing him after he's late for the meeting, Paris is whatever, and he's. Yeah, he is a kid who's gotten in trouble one too many times. He's turning into Judd Nelson from The Breakfast Club, I think.
Well, if he replicates a leather jacket, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that. But yeah, I think aside from what's happening with Tom Paris in this episode, you know, I think this is a fairly good episode. I wouldn't say that it's, you know, the best episode ever, but it's a solid character study for B'Elanna Torres. It says a lot about sort of where she was in the Maquis, where Chakotay was in the Maquis, and really, I think, speaks to it kind of contextualizes the Maquis a little bit and makes them out to be less of the sort of, you know, all guns blazing sort of pioneers that TNG and DS9 made them out to be. They seem a lot more careful than we've been led to believe.
Well, I think what I don't like about this episode is that it doesn't have an ending, mostly.
Yeah, that is true.
It just kind of ends, and it's like, I really wanted to see a conversation between Janeway and B'Elanna, because they're both, for this episode, dealing with the same problem kind of in parallel. And
I really wanted to see a conversation between Janeway and Kellum, alien guy, because they were developing a nice little relationship in this episode. I wanted a last scene with them to be like, I saved your planet. Thanks. Great. You know, maybe one day we'll all be in the Federation together or something.
Yeah, that it needed a little resolution. I really liked the action of the episodes in terms of we've run against a rock and we've got to fix it kind of an episode. This is an excellent one. Again, it gets to see, we get to see some more of B'Elanna. And B'Elanna is a character that, when it's her episode, I like her.
I think I know what you mean by that.
Because I think this is actually giving me a new wrinkle on that question you asked earlier of how it uses its... Because it's true, when B'Elanna's not really having an episode, there isn't really anything to distinguish her, Tom Paris, Harry Kim, whoever talks about the tachyon beam on the nacelle, that could be anybody. Again, it seems like they just give that throwaway line to whoever had the least lines, kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I agree with you, and I think the other wrinkle with B'Elanna is that, you know, when she just appears on the bridge, you know, in a scene that in an episode that is not her episode, they just kind of write her as shouty and angry all the time. And I don't know that really works for her, because when it's her episode, certainly she gets frustrated easily. And that is something that is a character beat that is pretty well established at this point. I mean, I think that you see that all throughout Dreadnought. She's increasingly frustrated very easily with herself, I guess.
Well, yeah, no, I thought that was wonderful. This is the second episode in which her antagonist is literally herself in a way. I thought that was fairly clever, actually.
Well, it makes sense, certainly. And I think that, you know, it's funny because, you know, I keep going back to Janeway's line in that one episode about, you know, we really need a counselor. And
yeah,
B'Elanna Torres is pretty unhappy with herself. And it seems to me that she has a lot of sort of self-esteem issues. I don't know. She keeps getting into situations where she has to pretty much like fight against herself or argue with herself.
But I would say this is more about her arguing with a past version of herself. The one where she was split, she's dealing with the conflict between her human and Klingon selves. This she's dealing with her past. This is a version of B'Elanna who has finally, if reluctantly, understood that things need to be cleared with your captain. The captain is, as Janeway has made clear, the one who is able to see everything by virtue of their position from the most angles, and therefore the person who is going to take the ultimate responsibility and who should be able to foresee everything. B'Elanna very specifically says that she reprogrammed the Dreadnought because she thought, oh, this would be a great idea, and Chakotay may not have had as fully fleshed out of a leadership style as Janeway did at that time, but it was still his call to look at that, to see any possible outcomes. Gee, could this backfire on us in any way? At this point, I mean, it's funny because B'Elanna's already learned that lesson, and now she's getting bit in the ass by something from her past that she did wrong, that she understands why she did it wrong, and yet she still has to deal with this. She still has to clean up her own mess. And I think it is very... I appreciate that as opposed to Chakotay, she is cleaning up her own mess with the support of the rest of the crew. She isn't just saying, like, I've got to solve this problem on my own. But yeah, I think this episode is about B'Elanna having done something wrong, maybe well-meaning, but wrong and in her past, and having to clean that up and dealing with how shitty she may have been in the past.
Yeah, certainly to some degree, I think that's true. And it's interesting to me because Chakotay and B'Elanna have a very, I don't want to say strange relationship, but it kind of is. It's, you know, it's a kind of relationship where I think B'Elanna respects Chakotay so much and looks up to him and almost views him as sort of a father figure in a way.
Yeah.
Which is strange, I guess, or not strange, because she had kind of, I think, a I think she had a weird relationship with her own father. So in a sense, because I think he left, right? She grew up with her mother. Is that right? Because her father was human and her mother was Klingon. Yeah. So
I think it would be fairer to say she had no relationship with her father.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's true. And so her looking to Chakotay as a surrogate father figure completely makes sense to me. I mean, Chakotay is very gentle. Chakotay is very soft-spoken. You know, he probably makes great warm milk. And he's very, very nice to you all the time, even when he's berating you and kind of dressing you down.
Yeah, and what does she say that he said to her? He was disappointed. I mean, that's such a I'm very disappointed in you. Like, and that's the thing your dad says that, like, kills you.
Yeah, that's an incredibly dad thing to say. And it's right. Like, she really wants to not disappoint Chakotay. And then she thinks that finally, you know, Chakotay went to bat for her when they first got stuck on Voyager and really argued with Captain Janeway to make her chief engineer. She has been doing her damnedest to become a really good Starfleet officer and be a really good chief engineer. And yeah, she's had a little bit of missteps here and there, but I think for the most part, she's done a pretty good job of that. And then here comes this horrible, huge mistake from her past that really made her relationship with Chakotay kind of rocky for a while. And here it is again, thrown in her face. And I think it's one of those things where it really, you know, I wonder about what the point of it is, but I think that the point of it is to indicate that A, B'Elanna is more healthy mentally than she used to be, but is perhaps not completely all there yet.
Yeah, I think what's also significant is that neither Janeway nor Chakotay nor anybody really seems to be upset with B'Elanna at this point. I mean, there is no, well, B'Elanna, I'm still disappointed. She's already made her atonement for this. They all know that she already has changed and is not the person who set this up. So it is more of a, well, this is a problem, but we have to deal with it. How are we dealing with this rather than assigning the blame? And I think that is an important mark of where her relationships with both Chakotay and Janeway are.
I think so, too, because I think that in general, it doesn't really, it's not really in Janeway or Chakotay's character to berate B'Elanna for kind of a result that was not intentional and really could not even be seen. I mean, the idea that, I mean, Dreadnought even says, of course, that there's no real possible way that a Dreadnought could actually be in the Delta Quadrant. And so that's pretty much just, you know, it's almost like, you know, I can't even think of an analogy, but it's like blaming something on ghosts, you know, it's like, and then it actually is a ghost, you know, like, it's just weird that it would actually be true. But it is true that this kind of just bizarre happenstance thing occurred that nobody could foresee. They are 75,000 light years from where they were. Yeah. And Dreadnought doesn't believe it. You know, B'Elanna is shocked. Chakotay's shocked. Janeway is like, what the fuck is going on? We have to fix this. But at the end of the day, they're not going to berate her because they know that that's not going to help fix the problem either.
Yeah. I think it's, I guess what I love about her programming is like how complete it is. And yet, she didn't foresee the need to explain to Dreadnought that something of this nature occurred in a way. I mean, I guess like I really love the, I didn't teach it how to lie. Well, yes, that was actually this scenario that you programmed in, you know, in a way B'Elanna is too clever for herself, but yeah, this is the unknown known, right? Unknown unknown that you would be warped into the Delta Quadrant that nobody could have figured out.
Yeah, because I think that I mean, Dreadnought's an interesting case as well, of course, because A, it indicates exactly how smart B'Elanna is, as you say. But it also kind of indicates, I mean, it goes back to this kind of evolution of artificial intelligence in Star Trek. I mean, there's no indication that Dreadnought is what Star Trek would call sentient, but it is the case that it's learning and that B'Elanna created it. And so, especially coming on the heels of Prototype from a couple of weeks ago, where B'Elanna, you know, basically wanted to help a artificial race have children, it may even indicate that this is an interest of hers, that she wants to go into artificial intelligence to some degree. It seems like she would be really good at it.
Well, part of the reason she knows Data so well. If she, it is an indication of a strong interest in the field that she knows so much about him.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Katarians then, because I find them interesting, not because they're interesting, but more because this is a very, very standard Star Trek plot. They are going to save the aliens of the week from the disaster. But it's different in two ways. It's different, A, because the aliens at first have basically said, we don't want your help because you're going to come and take all our shit. And also, B, that this is really something that is their fault. And Janeway doesn't really, you know, she doesn't elide it, and she doesn't sort of sugarcoat it. She basically says, yeah, you know what, we need to fix this because this is our fault. Interestingly enough, I don't think she says that to the Katarians, does she? So maybe that's a line too far. She knows that their reputation in the Delta Quadrant is being, you know, it's being hurt by the Kazon lies. And I think it's interesting at this point that this idea about Voyager being a ship of death is coming from the Kazon as some sort of campaign of misinformation is an interesting idea.
But again, the Voyager is coming up and says, oops, a gigantic bomb is coming to your planet. So, you know, there is kind of a point. I guess what's unique about the species is this is the first one that they really seem to be able to engage with on a face level, right? Like, the Katarians aren't being deceptive. They are who they are the entire time. If they are mistrustful, they have a reason to be, and a legitimate one that Janeway does not disavow. And frankly, when he does realize, no, they actually have been working like crazy to do, and they are legitimately willing to sacrifice the ship if that's what they need be, and realizing that they are serious about that.
Sure.
This is, I guess, one of the big reasons I wanted to see a final scene, because, as they say, this is the first real friend they've made in the Delta Quadrant. I mean,
yeah.
I want to see them come back to this. I want to see the banquet that they have. You know, I feel like that was a missed opportunity there. But it is good to know that maybe this is a sign that in this little region, at least, their fortunes might be turning around a bit. I mean, yes, the Kazon have been giving rumors that that was a ship of death, and things with the Kazon didn't end great the last time we saw them. But Janeway did warn the Kazon that they were about to be attacked. I mean, that is going to be another rumor. People know that, and that is going to be talked about. I mean, this is one of the things I like about this is, as far out and isolated as they feel they are in a region of space that does have communications from planet to planet. There is gossip going around here.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think that's right. Well, number one, I should correct myself. They're not the Katarians. The Katarian is the species that is Naomi, not Naomi. What's her name? Wildman? Ensign Wildman.
Oh, yeah, Gress Krendrick.
Yeah, that's her husband's species. I just looked at my notes. These aliens, I think, were the Rakosans or the Rakosians or something. Anyway.
Why is Gress Krendrick such a bad name? Like, I love that name.
It's a badass name. I would love to be named Gress Krendrick. I can't say it, but I would love to be named it. Maybe I'll name my next dog that.
Can we just hang on that point for 1 second? Because I feel like we might elide it. But I don't know, development in the whole the Doctor trying to get a name thing and getting a little miff that Kes didn't suggest her father's name. I don't know if that is ever going to add to anything, because I've never known the Doctor as anything other than the Doctor. But anyway.
I think that should probably indicate that the Doctor never actually chooses a name.
Yeah,
but
that's pretty much all I had to say about that. All right, back to the non-Katarians.
No, I think the last thing I want to say about the Rakosan subplot is that, or plot, I guess, I don't know. There really isn't a subplot in this episode. It's all kind of subplots. It speaks, I think it's really smart on this episode's part in particular to have the Rakosans be so skeptical of Captain Janeway when she first hails them, because she is not yet internalized the fact that she is in the Delta Quadrant, that these species have never heard of the Federation before, have never heard of Starfleet before, and that a Starfleet captain hailing an alien planet and saying, there is a giant bomb heading to your planet, and we are here too, is going to read very differently in the Alpha Quadrant and the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not going to be, oh, thank God the Federation is here, they'll fix this, because the Federation always fixes things. Again, all they've heard is that the Federation has fucked up the Kazon ship. The Federation has killed a gigantic immortal entity. The Federation has, you know, plundered ships, and here we are. Oh, and again, hey, we're here and there's a bomb.
Yeah. So maybe the last thing I want to say before we move on to Death Wish, because whoa, is I don't know when they changed the procedure to set off the self-destruct in Starfleet, but it used to require two
people. Yeah.
And now it's just Janeway. So I guess if Janeway has a bad day, she could just blow the ship up. Or if she got taken over by an alien, which happens all the fucking time on Star Trek, she could just blow the ship up without anybody else being able to do anything about it. That seems like a bad idea. I don't know if that's a lack of attention to detail on the show's part or if that is an actual change that is made because nobody cares about Voyager. I don't know, but it just seemed odd to me.
Okay, it's sad that I noticed that, too.
No, it's not sad. It indicates that you're moving into being a Trekkie.
Oh, God. Well, this is what's happening. the Kazon, the Maquis guy who is working with the Kazon is a bad spy. I think we need...
Yeah, he is. He's terrible at this.
Again, I have no idea where that's going to end up, but I am glad that they're progressing it. That's kind of all that.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely going to come to some sort of resolution of this plot line with the Kazon. I will just leave it at that. We will find out exactly how satisfying it is at some point. And like I said, they will not be in Kazon space forever, so this will have a defined endpoint at some point.
No, I mean, my assumption is probably, you know, I would guess this is where they would go with the season finale at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, well, let's move on to Death Wish.
So my first note for Death Wish was, oh, what I'm going to have by the end of this episode, because I didn't think that a Q episode could possibly be good, but, I mean, this is obviously trying to be its Measure of a Man moment, right? Like, literally, it's a trial episode. It is trying to deal with a relatively sophisticated social concept. It's not as good as Measure of a Man, what is, but I kind of liked this episode, and I liked how Q is in this episode.
Yeah, I like Death Wish a lot. I think that, you know, we have talked before about Q. Q did not endear me at all. I'm never really a fan of Q. I find Q episodes tiresome. And they're never as funny as they think they are. And also, Q did not work on Deep Space Nine. I think the first thing to grapple with is Q is on Voyager. Did you expect to see Q on Voyager after he did not work on DS9 at all?
I don't remember if I knew that Q appeared on Voyager. I feel like I wasn't shocked to want to find him, I guess. So that might have been just something that I heard at one point, but... He does fit in a lot better in this show than he did in DS9. I mean, I barely... All I remember about the Q episode of DS9 was Sisko fucking punching him in the face and saying, well, I'm not Picard. And
that's all you really need to remember about that episode.
Yeah, that was about... And that was exactly why Q didn't work on DS9. But especially given the themes of DS9, which was more about... The war was more about the political conflicts between opposed groups. Q is a very outside and outsized figure that, I mean, Q in DS9 and is not something that you want for the Dominion War arc, right? That's something that kind of muddies those waters if he's appearing every so often.
Yeah.
And here, where they're out in a weird region of space with different things happening and anything could happen, Q appearing is just another thing of weird shit that they deal with. Last week, we dealt with a gigantic bomb that was, you know, from Cardassian space. At one point, we had a giant amoeba. I mean, and now we have Q. Why not?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I think that, you know, I Q worked, and I use that term loosely, on TNG primarily because of the chemistry he had with the rest of the cast. And,
yeah.
You know, he had really good chemistry with Patrick Stewart. He had really good chemistry with Gates McFadden. You know, a lot of characters, a lot of actors on that show played off him very well. And he also was kind of obsessed with the Enterprise and Picard in particular in a way that sort of made sense. It was his choice to go to the Enterprise, right? It was not his choice to go to DS9, right? He went there to be with Vosh, and he could have been anywhere, right? He could have been on Beta Z. He could have been in Paris. You know, he could have been wherever. It didn't matter. There was no reason for him to be there. And so all of his little tricks and engaging with the Deep Space Nine crew in Q-less felt very, very... It just kind of felt like they were, A, not really in their own episode of their own television show, and B, it just felt like Q was trying to recapture what he did on the Enterprise because they didn't know what else to do with Q.
And also, in a way, on the Enterprise, they kind of have to deal with Q because it's the Enterprise, and that's the more warm and fuzzy Star Trek.
Right.
In DS9, they have no time for this shit. Like, even less so than Picard. I mean, Sisko is not going to grin and bear it.
Yeah, like things on Deep Space Nine are breaking down all the time. They've got bombs going off on the promenade. They have no time for this. Whereas Voyager, I think, you know, in a similar way, Q did not want to go there. He got called there because this, I don't know what the fuck to call him, I guess Q and Q2.
Yeah. That's how I referred to him.
You know, Q2 gets released from this, or he's the first Q in the episode, so maybe we should call him Q, and then Q2 the other Q.
No!
That, you know, he doesn't want to be there either. The Q gets called there because Q2 gets released from this comet. And, you know, the only reason I think why Q works, there's a couple reasons why Q works in this episode and why this is a good Q episode. Number one, I think, is that they actually have a point, right? This is actually a well-constructed episode that has a point to make and is well-written. The other point is that Kate Mulgrew and I can't remember the guy's name who plays Q.
John DeLancey.
John DeLancey, thank you.
Look at me becoming a Trekkie and knowing actor names.
You get a cookie.
I love cookie.
They play off each other very well.
And in a different way than Patrick Stewart and John DeLancey played off each other. I mean, I like how Q is not the gadfly in this episode. He's not just trying a little bit, but his existence is not simply to piss people off and cause mischief like he does sometimes in TNG. I mean, in the best Q episodes like the fucking one where he introduces them to the Borg, or
Q-Who.
Yeah, in Q Who, or Tapestry, or All Good Things, where he is serving at, you know, to deal with the plot rather than, oh, I'm causing the plot. Ah. I mean, he really serves. It's, I think in this episode, we actually grapple with Q with the inner life of Q in a way that we never did in TNG. And initially, in this episode, I found all of the Q world building to be a little off-putting because I felt it was demystifying it. In a way, going, you know, talking more about the Q and finding out about, you know, having their own opinions on their immortality and all like that, and having a two Qs that could have a discussion about that. I mean, even in the little bits we saw of them of other Q in TNG, it wasn't as much of a relationship like this. So having such a disparity between the two Qs, like I said, it was a little off-putting, but as it's going on, it's, I don't know, there's a weird tragicness to Q that never existed earlier and that I kind of like. I mean, I like that this episode ends with Q growing. That's a very weird thing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I think that I kind of love this episode's take on the Q continuum. I mean, the Q continuum, I mean, I will put my cards on the table. I think the Q are a stupid idea. I think the Q continuum is stupid. I don't think it's very well thought out, and you should probably think about it as little as possible, right?
Yeah.
But I like the fact that this episode takes the Q and the Q continuum deadly seriously, no pun intended, and really extrapolates out and thinks about what a race of quote-unquote omnipotent beings who could not die would actually do, right? Like, what would their mindset be like? What would their psyche be like? What would their society be like? And then what it turns out to be is just they're fundamentally bored. And that's a really interesting take on the Q.
It's a slight retcon. I think even Q2 says a bit like, well, you know, he's exaggerating, or, you know, that's just what he says about. Almost everything we've learned about Q and TNG was from Q himself, and he has reason to not be completely honest about who he is, what his people are like, and all of that. Mostly because he's just picking whatever will piss off Picard the most.
Interestingly enough, I think that the timeline of Q's journey as a person is very interesting in the episode, because Q2 says that he was in that comet for imprisoned for 300 years. Yeah. So he was, you know, back in the 1900s or whatever. We have known Q in TNG as that very sort of mischief causing irreverent kind of gadfly, essentially. But Q2 never knew him as the sort of chastised version very much. It seems that he was imprisoned very, like, right after Q was chastised. And so I kind of like the idea that the Q that we saw in TNG was from, like, 300 years ago. Because what does time really matter to the Q?
Yeah.
Right?
I tried to square that circle, because wasn't Q made mortal at one point in the run of TNG? And that didn't make sense. But then I think there is an amount of, listen, they're Q. It doesn't really matter.
Exactly, you know,
Time can be weird and not like ours. But, if there is any demystifying, it is in the service of, well, Q was exaggerating because he kind of became a born-again Q for a little bit, and so he would be talking about. And in a way, it also makes us understand kind of why Q was so obsessed with Picard, because for this very, very brief moment, Q found something really interesting again. Q is fascinated by Picard because he's the most interesting thing he's seen in centuries.
Right. I mean, what I keep finding so striking about this episode is, you know, when Q2 goes to talk to Tuvok in the mess hall, and, you know, he says, "You've surprised me," and that is such a rare treat for a Q. And he's got this really sad, just not even depressed, but just resigned sort of expression on his face. And I don't know, there's just something about this episode that you know, you could argue that it is a little bit of a retcon, but I think it's more that it is extrapolating out and treating the Q as seriously as other things are being treated. I mean, in a way, this is the best indication yet for why the Q should be in Star Trek at all.
I was surprised that they eventually go with, you know, that Janeway does decide in a, you know, well, yes, you have lived enough, and, you know, yes, she does want him to live as a human for a while, and that doesn't work out, but I was surprised it didn't end in a, listen, you know, after centuries, Q met Picard, and that was interesting to him, and there are still new things happening, and even though you've seen everything, there are new civilizations, and there is more to explore. You haven't been maybe through the entire universe yet, and all of that kind of a thing.
But in a certain sense, doesn't that kind of justification kind of read like telling a bored person that there's books they haven't read yet? You know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, it's like, well, yeah, there's books I haven't read, but I've read a lot of fucking books. So what's reading another book that I haven't read yet really going to do for my fundamental boredom?
Yeah, and that is fair. Yeah, I don't want to suggest that it's a, well, have you tried being not depressed? Why don't you smile? Because if you're smiling on the outside, you'll start smiling on the inside.
Oh, God. Yeah. Maybe Tuvok should have said that to him. Maybe that would have worked, because Tuvok doesn't smile, so he should have said, well, I'm depressed all the time, but you don't see me complaining about it. Well, what do you make of Q, the Q2 as a character then? Like, because I think this is a really interesting take on the Q as a concept, but we also have to grapple with Q2 as a character and as a person.
Yeah, I mean, he's... I'm not sure where to begin really with him. I mean, he is in a way your academic who has thought about everything and seen it all and has become tired of life. London is and is now tired of life. I think he does make his case for the unbearability of it, and I think it does make the point that, I mean, this is a theme that is in a lot of science fiction and fantasy stuff. So immortality, you eventually get bored with it, and you know, death becomes the one adventure you haven't had yet, and you know, that's the one thing you cannot experience as an immortal being, and so it becomes the thing you want the most. I mean, it is the kind of theme that doesn't apply at all to real life, right? I mean, unless you're talking about, you know, those billionaires who get teenage blood pumped into their veins and stuff, and, you know, I want my brain to be on computer. I don't know. This is something that we can only think of
right
in the abstract at this point in time. We can, you know, I can probably say that I think a immortal existence would be horrible, and I can see why, but is that just me extrapolating from all of the science fiction I've read and watched?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I honestly don't know. And I think the episode does a good job of explaining itself just enough to make, because it's not even that immortality is, I don't know that he's really arguing that immortality is unbearable for all of the Q. He's certainly arguing that it's unbearable for him, and that he even says at one point that immortality is the disease that he is suffering from. Now, I think that's a nice line. I don't know if I agree with that necessarily, but it is the case that he has a certain sort of mindset or a certain sort of psyche or personality that is not reacting well to immortality. I mean, when they go to the Q continuum, and it's obviously very abstracted, and it's very, very surrealistic and stylistic, and I kind of love it. You know, this is a big moment in Star Trek. This is the first time that anybody has gone to the Q continuum that we know of that's not Q, and that we're seeing what it actually is. And it's really fucking horrible. Like, it's horrible in such a sort of pedestrian way. It's just boring. Like, nothing bad is happening. It's just people are standing around, essentially.
Basically vaguely reading a magazine. Yeah, no one's talking. There is no, I mean, this is what the original series would call a stagnant society, right?
Yeah.
This is almost like this reminds me in some ways of the Apple. This is going to be, you know, you view this today, you view this a million years from now, it will be this. There will be nothing different. There will be no growth. There will be no change. And I mean, the only it is interesting how Q2 does spur the original Q on to change, although, you know, he did have his rebellion at some point, so obviously things have spurred our Q to change before. Things can and do change in the Q continuum, but I assume it's very rare. And again, if our Q finds it so horrible, and he's maybe the most unusual one, he is the most deviant of his species, you can assume how conservative Q are.
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, in a strange way, the episode seems to be arguing that immortality and omnipotence, and I will say omnipotence even though, you know, Q2 seems to indicate that that's a little bit of an advertising campaign on the Q continuum's part, that they may not be as omnipotent as people think they are, that essentially they're just, I don't know, it's the case where they are stagnant, as you say, but at the same time, there is no real indication that any of them are unhappy enough with the status quo to do anything about it. And what is really, you're right, like, they're fundamentally conservative. There's a sort of weird thing where being omnipotent and being immortal is actually, is that's kind of the it's like the sunk cost fallacy. They don't want to jeopardize that because they really value their omnipotence and their immortality, but they're not doing anything with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the question. Are they enjoying the nothing life? I mean, they may just consider it to be a calm, cyclical existence where, you know, one is just silently observing, maybe, and otherwise just ambiently existing, that may be a pleasurable existence. To some, that may be a version of heaven. And obviously for Q and Q2, that's not the case. They want Q2 especially wants debate and, you know, intellectual conflict and stimulation and new stuff. I mean, and Q seems to be liking that as well. He likes to see humanity progressing, and he likes when Picard challenges him. In many ways, Q is interested in Picard because Picard is one of the few who's a good match for him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also wonder about, you know, Q obviously likes to be challenged, and he kind of got chastised, but he's finding, you know, this is really like Q got his groove back, right? Which may be bad or not, I don't know. But in the case of the Q continuum, you know, Q2 mentions this idea about the new era. We don't know what that is. I mean, we see somebody reading a magazine that says old and then a magazine that says new. Again, it's very surrealistic and stylized. But, you know, that seems to indicate that there was some sort of massive change in the Q continuum's culture or society that has gotten stagnant again. And it's almost as though this entire episode is arguing for another Q continuing renaissance.
Yeah, and maybe the death of Q2 and Q backed up to some new tricks is going to trigger that. I mean, that is part of the suggestion of the ending, that this is going to begin a new cycle.
So leaving aside the Q continuum stuff, how do you feel about the courtroom scenes? Like, I think in a certain sense, you're right. Like, they're obviously very influenced by Measure of a Man. That was a very influential early episode of TNG that really... I think that was one of the first episodes of the show that was an unabashed classic and sort of said to people, okay, it's okay to watch this show again. And it's been very influential on the franchise, or at least Berman era Star Trek. What do you think of the courtroom scenes in this episode?
I like them. I mean, in some ways it is slightly didactic, although this is the era around when Jack Kevorkian was becoming very, notorious, right? Like, this is when assisted suicide and euthanasia these are topics that come up in every society from time to time, but this was an era where that was being talked out a lot. I mean, I live in Oregon right now, and there is an assisted suicide law on the books. It's legal, and I believe it was around this time that was passed, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so certainly this is Voyager trying to deal with a contemporary topic in a in maybe a very abstracted way, again, where, you know, or a very metaphorical way. I guess I'm also thinking about the episode because the show, this franchise has done the assisted suicide episode before, which is the one where Worf broke his back.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that the show says no when it is somebody who is in a physical condition which has gone beyond medicine being able to save or alleviate, and yet when it's coming to just existential depression and ennui and just a feeling of being done, it grudgingly says yes, there can be a point. And maybe this is just a couple of years difference in between, a different writer's perspective, a different – you know, this is – part of the difference between the TNG crew and the Voyager crew. They will have different outlooks. And yet I wonder if, because Voyager isn't giving up though. I mean, Voyager has the 75 year journey ahead of them. I mean, that's the equivalent of a death sentence of something that their goal is impossible. And yet they're saying, we're not going to take the assisted suicide route, take the nice planet from the 37s where we will be happy, we will be among our own people, we will be able to, this is the next best thing, we need to keep going on in spite of all of the obstacles. I mean, in some ways, the ending of the episode feels, it doesn't sit right with me in a way that I like very much.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It is made very clear that for Janeway, this is a very difficult decision, even setting aside Q trying to bribe her and her knowing, you know, what this will lead to and all of those kind of things.
Right. I think so. And I don't know, because you bring up that episode of TNG, and I don't remember exactly – finding that episode that I didn't like that. I don't remember liking that episode, right? Because I had problems with Picard essentially carte blanching and saying, no, you can't kill yourself, right? Like, it seemed a little weird to me.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, it might just be that that was, you know, a previous era and this is a couple years later. And so societal attitudes have shifted a little bit, or a different writer, like you said. But I think that in terms of what this episode is arguing for, specifically with Janeway's decision to allow, and because remember, this isn't really about him committing suicide. I mean, it is, but that's what they're actually litigating in that courtroom is whether or not she is going to give him asylum. And, of course, yes, you can say, well, that's a Weasley way out, because we all know what the outcome of him getting asylum is going to be. It's going to be him killing himself, as indeed it is. But
which she even acknowledges during her final statement. She does say, like, I'm trying to make this just be about asylum, but you've told me the second I get asylum, I'm stabbing myself everywhere.
But it's interesting to me because, you know, this seems to be a fundamental shift in the way in which the Star Trek franchise treats assisted suicide. And this isn't really assisted suicide. It's just the right to commit suicide. I mean, maybe that's really the difference. Like, I don't know. It seems weird to me that this episode is coming out and saying, well, the state is essentially torturing a man because he does not want to continue to live, and so we cannot allow that to happen. Whereas, isn't that exactly what Picard decided at the end of that episode of TNG?
Yeah, it's only a miracle of the last few pages of script that Klingon Anatomy happens to allow Worf to get out of the episode all right. If that particular little feature weren't in the episode, Picard would be condemning him to, all right, you've got the best chance you have is you can sort of get around with certain prosthetics.
Right. And you know, we're not arguing that people that have physical disabilities should kill themselves. That is not what we are saying. I mean, this is definitely that in that episode, that is definitely Worf's perspective, and I think we need to honor that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, because at the end of the episode, of course, he does kill himself, and he kills himself essentially because Q gives him the ability to kill himself. I mean, it's kind of striking to me that the Q has made this almost complete 180, but I don't know, maybe Q2 has served his purpose in this episode and ending Q's life, that really the purpose of what this entire episode was about was, again, getting Q's mojo back in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, Q's thing is, you know, Q's the trickster, right? Q doesn't really like people who are pompous because, you know, he's the best and nobody else, you know, someone else who thinks they're the best has to be taken down a peg so they know their place and all of that. And Q is arguing for the rules of his society. In a way, it kind of makes Q2 kind of makes him realize that he's become a bit of a company man, and he's that's not who Q is, damn it.
Yeah, Q's become boring, and that is the most horrifying thing that he can become, and he realizes it.
I appreciate that, I guess, a little more talking about it in this manner.
Yeah.
I I'm just all of a sudden thinking about the final episode with Worf's brother, though, where Worf's brother comes and asks to be assisted suicided, and Worf comes up with the plan to essentially wipe his memory and start him over again after trying as much as he can to get him a job, get him a life.
Well, let's be clear, though. He does kill him. I mean, well, Worf agrees and, you know, he kills him, and the only way that he survives is because, I mean, I forget exactly why, but, you know, Dr. Bashir walks into the room and goes, ah, you know, or something happens.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
So,
that's
Worf, I mean, I like the fact that, you know, the series has, or the franchise has grappled with these kind of questions all throughout the franchise, and, you know, it seems to be moving more and more towards the assisted suicide is okay option, which I'm fine with, but, I think that Janeway would never do it, and she tries to convince Q2/Quinn that this life is worth living, but he obviously doesn't think so.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the last thing to talk about with Death Wish then before we wrap this episode up is, of course, you know, we haven't talked about Riker. Riker's in this episode.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
And, you know, I don't know how much there is to say about it. He's not in it very much, and he doesn't really have anything to do. It just seemed to be a way to shoehorn him into the episode more than anything else, but It's more of an indication that Voyager is much more comfortable with using characters from previous shows than DS9 ever was.
I guess it's just, I just feel there are two points. Number one, I wish Janeway had at the beginning to said, well, I'll do this trial, but in return, take us home. Because then later, Q uses it as a bargaining chip. I mean, she has the right to demand a payment for her services, and that isn't a huge payment from the Q's perspective. Number two, Q says, oh, their memories will be erased. And in the case of Isaac Newton and
Maury Ginsburg.
And Maury Ginsburg, who is the reason that Woodstock was able to happen on time.
Sure.
Like, in their cases, yes, you want to fog their memory, that's fine. But Riker knows all about Q, right, already. He understands exactly what's going on. He's not upset or anything. And at the very least, let the guy take a message back to Starfleet, because he's as worried as anybody about what happened to them. He has the answer. He can at least say they're safe, they're in the Delta Quadrant, they send love to their families, and let's figure out a way we can get them back.
Yeah, that did seem to be a little weird to me, because it kind of was the show having its cake and eating it too, that they wanted to bring Riker on the show, which, okay, fine. I always like seeing Riker. He's a good character, and that little glee in his eye when he meets Catherine Janeway is hilarious and wonderful.
Well, we know how Riker feels about beautiful women with great brains.
Yeah, he wants to fuck her, and that's fine. But consensually and respectfully. But then, you know, you're right. Like the rules against interfering in other cultures have nothing to do with Q. I mean, as Janeway even says in this episode, Q introduced the Federation to the Borg. And so, you're right. Why not just let Riker go back to Starfleet Command and say, hey, remember this USS Voyager? Yeah, they're in the Delta Quadrant and everything's cool, but they're stuck there, so they're trying to get home. Like, you're right. Like, I think it's a little strange.
I was wondering if they were going to... I do feel like it was a missed opportunity to maybe have him playing his ancestor. That might have been funny. But anyway, yeah, it was nice to see the man
I think
again.
That would have turned it into a little bit of dinner theater, and I don't know that that would have really been great, but...
I love dinner theater. I guess my last note is, and this is really just shoehorned in, but I really want to use the term Q-icide. Can I just use it now?
You can. And I think in another universe, maybe that would have been the name of this episode. But I appreciate the restraint that the producers of Star Trek Voyager displayed in not giving this episode a Q pun title. It has a very nice episode title that is all about the gravitas of the moment. And I appreciate that.
But I have to say, though, if it had a Q title... Last week, I would have freaked the fuck out when you said the name of the episode coming up, and we deprived our listeners of that moment.
That is true, but it's also possible that Q appears again on Voyager, so take heart.
Yes, well, he did. Aww.
All right, well, I think that's it for this episode of the podcast. If you have any thoughts on either of these episodes, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. You can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/trekaboutshow. Which is a way for you to support us financially if you enjoy our podcasts so much that you want to give us some money every month. It also supports our other podcasts tuning in. We are releasing our episode this week on the X-Files episodes Irresistible and De Haan de Verlitz. We're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Trekaboutshow Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an iTunes review for Trekabout. Next week, we're talking about the Star Trek Voyager episodes, Life Signs, and Investigations.